Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. Jamia Wilson invoked Coretta Scott King in our conversation, reminding us that struggle needs to be fought and won in every generation. I drew from Jamia, an activist, an author, and the director of the longest-running feminist publisher in the world, A Lesson on Endurance. In her childhood, Jamia was imbued with respect for her elders and for the sacrifices they made so she could have the freedoms she takes for granted today, and how it's her sacred honor to build on that legacy for the next generation. It's a humble, grounded orientation that brings into relief our interconnection. We spoke of what it means to hold the complexities and to live into the questions, to not be satisfied with definitive answers, with how she cultivates a tribe of luminous elders and mentors today, and why that's so meaningful and important in her work. She tells stories of times when she's had a change of heart that informs her beliefs that others can too. And that helps keep her going as she builds a movement of justice and equality for every single one of us. Your work has spoken to me for so long, so I'm just very excited to finally like sit with you face to face.
Thank you, yeah. And I love what you're doing.
Thank you.
I just like believe in storytelling as such an important way to make connections, so thank you for letting me be a part.
So I just wanted to talk about a little bit of your background and your childhood. Mm. So you come from I understand, an evangelical kind of Christianity, mm-hmm. and that was a thread that really informs your activism and your work today. So I just wanted to, can you just give me a sense of that, like put us at your kitchen table, like what was it like in your home, and how did that spirituality inform your life growing up?
Growing up, I, you know, have these memories of evangelical Christianity and African-American Southern tradition. My dad's side being Baptist, missionary Baptist background, and my mom's side being African-American Episcopal, Methodist Episcopal, Amy Zion. And then I went to an Episcopalian boarding school for girls in Maryland when I was in high school. So I always kind of had this strong tradition of Christianity, different denominations, but liturgical connection to the book as the word, and the importance of telling other people about it. But my parents were also very liberal and involved in civil rights activism, and it was interesting to kind of be raised with a Democrat sort of sensibility as it related to how my family voted and how they kind of labeled and identified themselves, while also being deeply religious, quoting the Bible often, singing a lot of scripture, listening to a lot of gospel, myself knowing the Bible really well. And so for me, it's been really interesting as I am out in the world as a feminist speaker and writer, and sometimes having people be shocked when I say I self-identify as a Christian and a feminist and a proud and loud one of both. Because sometimes people think those things can't be synonymous, but I was actually taught that those things are very much connected, mm-hmm. although there are times in which there can be friction between where my beliefs lie, what I've been told by other people's interpretation of the book, the word, and what I believe is the connection to the true divine and God, the whole truth. And I would say God versus the institution of a political church, that I think people rely on political churches as structures to find connection, order, tradition in. And as I get older, and I think I always had an inherent feeling of this as well, and I think there's nothing wrong with finding community in church. I found that what calls to me most is the power, the energy, the truth outside of a container. But I know that there would be people who would disagree with my interpretation of that as well.
Well, that's just so you, outside of the container. You know, that like, it's, that's perfect. That's like your worldview in a, you know, in a nutshell, because you're just like all about breaking out of every container, you know.
It's true.
It's really cool.
Thank you for reflecting that back to me.
Yeah.
I've often felt that I'll say, yeah, I enjoy church. And I often leave church with many questions more so than answers. Whereas I know that, you know, I had been instructed mostly to go to find answers. You know, my dad used to say when I would be struggling with something, oh, you should go to church, you'll find the answer there. And there would be some truth to that. I would find some answers that would mainly be in terms of questions of exploration. And that, for me, has come into being more of a connection to God, more of a connection to asking God to imbue me with the strength and vision and clarity that I need to make the right moves, and to live in the honor of life and the honor of what is good. But I'm still on that path, and so it's been interesting for me now to think about the fact that I have no wish or desire to reject my religion, just as I have no wish or desire to reject feminism, although I've had people on all sides of that kind of push me to do that.
Yeah, because it's uncomfortable.
Yes.
It's not fitting in the container that we understand, and so it's hard to get our heads around, so we want you to change.
Yes, and I think some people find solace in tradition. Some people find solace in conformity. They find solace in institution. And maybe because I moved around a lot growing up, maybe because I was raised in a specific faith tradition but grew up in a country with a predominant faith that wasn't my own, all of that has led me to more so think about, okay, maybe the goal isn't being included or fitting into a mold that isn't necessarily made in my size. Mm-hmm. It's about paving new ground, exploring new realms of understanding, being okay, being outside of something and having graciously received something beautiful from it, but also understanding, hey, that might not be the whole truth for me. Mm-hmm. The either ours, the binaries don't work really well for me. And I know for some people they do, and that is the truth. But I think that the truth is just so much bigger than what the human capacity for understanding really is. Mm. And so that's something that I often say when I get into religious or ideological debate about people saying, well, I just don't know how you could, for example, be a Christian and also believe in reproductive justice, for example. And my view is that, you know, it's about interpretation and it's about the big truth. And when I believe in the big truth for myself, it's about mercy, non-judgment, love, faith, and hope. And there are other people for whom it might be grounded in something different. And the only arbiter of which of those is real and the truth, in my view, is God, not anyone who's mortal. And so it's something I think about a lot, but I feel really at peace with where I am right now, living in the question. And I don't feel afraid of having questions, even though I think there was a long time in which I was struggling with getting pushed back for having questions.
Mm, I love that. You're not afraid of the questions anymore.
I'm really not, which is scary a little bit to not be afraid. But because I think when people who need definitive answers see that you're not afraid of questions, that you're not afraid of nuance, that you're not afraid of the complexities, the people who need definitive lines drawn become very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Because then it's very hard for them to say black is black, white is white, X is X, Y is Y, either or, yes, no. And when you kind of dismantle that and say, oh, many of these truths can be true at the same time, many of these things can be held at the same time, there could be a third way instead of one or two ways. That can be really uncomfortable if you just need a yes or no. And I always see the people who believe in this are the people who always say that they are so logical or they are realists or they are non-emotional. I always feel that that's a good sign for me about who's a person who's afraid of the questions.
And they've been, you know, in compassion, I hold that with compassion because, you know, that has been the driving way that our culture has tried to teach us. That's the logical pragmatism that comes from our, you know, entire kind of Western mm-hmm. civilization, this divorcing of spirit and mind. We're just, you know, these heads walking around, no body. So that's been the way for so long. Of course, there's also been a tradition of deep questioning as well, but folks that aren't, you know, I don't know if it's like a Myers-Briggs profile, the one that's not comfortable with ambiguity. Yes. Like, that's a real personality type, and that's okay too, you know, and we need that kind of system, people to build bridges. You know, there's a way to do things, and you follow that.
Yes.
But we also need to hold a healthy respect, and right now we're so imbalanced. So when someone like you comes in and just, like, busts it all open, it can be very frightening.
And it is, and it's interesting because I think of, you know, we're talking about Myers-Briggs, and I'm an ENFJ, so I have judge in my personality. And for the longest time, I was trying to understand what that meant, to possess a sense of openness to complexity, openness to many different ways, and also have a strong sense of righteousness, depending on the day, whether it's righteousness or self-righteousness, depending on if you're talking to my champions or my foes. You know, I think our strengths are our weaknesses, but I think, you know, deep down, I do believe that that there's a higher truth that lives beyond sort of the superficial judgments that we're encouraged to have. You know, and so the question I ask myself a lot now, as I've kind of had these discoveries about what I'm thinking and how I'm hoping to live, is there fear behind me making a declarative or definitive decision? Is there fear behind me not wanting something to be done a different way? And that could be even something basic. I'll never forget years ago when I was managing a team, someone wanted to change something to Google Docs that I felt like should be managed in an easier way, because I didn't want to have to teach certain people how to use this new tool, which is funny now because Google Docs are not a new tool. And I had to ask myself, are you pushing back on this because it's new and it adds an extra step and you're afraid of change? Or is it because you really fear that the greater good will not be enacted for the team? And I really thought, no, it's fear. And I say this very basic example because I think it's just the thinking we need to have around who we are and the decisions we make, that something as arbitrary as Google Docs can really show you where you still need to grow as a person. And I learn from that kind of thing all the time of, like, when do I have a first judgment that is visceral, that has to do with my fear versus the greater good? That's a question I ask myself a lot now. And I think just the practice of that is really important. Not that I get it right every time, but being a Google Doc or life and death decisions or decisions about relationships.
Well, you start with the Google Doc.
Yes.
And you practice the muscle memory of noticing and watching your subconscious reaction. And then you get the bigger and tougher stuff once you get used to that, you get in that practice or that habit. So it makes perfect sense. And I think having a really good example is really helpful.
Because we think, right, we think it's always just the big profound questions. But, you know, I thought, oh, I'm being petty about a Google Doc because I was the one who set up the old system and now someone wants a new system and my ego doesn't like it. And it's not about my ego. It's about finding a system that works the best for the entire team. And, you know, just being able to have those kinds of pathways of thought, I think are really important, and to make light of them to ourselves, even to say, oh, you know, the Google Doc can teach us a lot, that we can always be better. We can wake up today and do something differently. I think is something that I'm really thinking about a lot.
You talk very powerfully and beautifully regularly about your ancestor presence and the guide that you feel from them. But what I wanted to draw you out on was something around, while that is real with you and full, mm-hmm. you also seem to create a new modern ecosystem of mm-hmm. wise elders mm-hmm. that surround you. You know, you've got some of the biggest luminaries, you know, at your disposal, it feels like, that you've cultivated these relationships, and they've in turn and probably even first sought you out and seen a real light in the work you're doing and the life you're living. You know, you've got Maxine Waters and Elizabeth Lesser and, you know, Gloria Steinem, who are here informing you as spiritual mothers. So I just wanted to talk about that practice of cultivating this tribe of the heart, these people, and is that connected to your ancestry?
I feel really lucky to come from a tradition where there's a value on elders and elder wisdom, and I grew up with strong grandmothers throughout my life, and even one of my great grandmothers I had in my life for a significant amount of time. So there was always this feeling of there's a lot that you need to learn from those who come before you. You need to listen. You need to revere and respect and honor them. They've been here longer. They've seen what you've seen and more, and they've gone through things that can help you with what you're going through. And they've sacrificed things that have made it possible for you to have things that you take for granted. And having that being very much embedded in the teaching culturally as well as religiously, I think it was kind of connected to spirit for me, made it so that I would seek out a lot of mentorship from people. When I would just come across people who I thought that there was something I could learn from, that I would ask them questions. Or if they took an interest in me, that I would really let them know that I still wanted to be connected. If I needed a challenging question for them, to ask those hard questions, because I kind of gravitate toward older women who are trailblazers, who are strong, who were the ones who would make a noise when they were being encouraged to be silent during the time in which they might have been at my same age in their lives. And I want to know how they did it so that I can learn from their example, but also understanding that I have my own unique take, that I have my own unique context, and that I have my own community, and the community of people who are coming up with me right now also knows what's good for us. One of the reasons why Gloria Steinem has been such an important figure and friend in my life is because she would reject the idea that a mentorship relationship wasn't a true partnership. She did not like hierarchy. She often says, we're linked, not ranked. And so when I would say, oh, I want you to mentor me on this, she'd say, I'll partner with you on this. But, or if I'd say, oh, I'm concerned about this thing that's happening in this particular moment with younger women in a conversation we're struggling with, and what do you think of critiques we're getting from older women about it? And she would sometimes say, hey, when I wanted to focus on certain issues that the women who came before us in the feminist movement focused on, they had different theories of change and different approaches they wanted to use. But I got mad on my own behalf in my moment, and that is what led to the work that we did. And so I think about that a lot, that she talked about this pattern we have a lot of sometimes the new generation also having new ideas and approaches that come with the wisdom and context of their time. And so it's a balance I'm trying to also connect with in terms of getting the wisdom from people who've come before me, but also surrounding myself with people who understand what it means to empower younger people to get mad on their own behalf, as Gloria would say, and to understand our own power in this moment. I really, really, really value the people who have inspired me to dig down deep and to see what power it is that I possess and to draw that out. You know, that there's sometimes this idea that there are people who will say, get off my lawn, you need to earn your stripes. Those don't tend to be the people that I think are caught up in transformation. So when I seek mentorship and guidance, I'm seeking the people who are really interested in continuing a thread of change. And those are the people who understand that in order to have change be continuous and sustainable, that you have to invest in the new generation. And that doesn't mean that the new generation is going to get it right all the time or not upset things or maybe even dismantle some things that you worked really hard to build, but it means that you trust them and you trust their energy and their intellectualism and their passion and community enough to continue the work. And so those are the people that I really look to, and I've been lucky to find them in my life. And there's just, you know, a lot of people who in this world and in the beyond who have helped me in that way. My friend's mother, Rochelle Figueroa, she was a beautiful indigenous grandmother who I met through Women of Spirit and Faith, and she passed away after being at Standing Rock as one of the grandmothers there. And it was a really devastating loss. And I think about the gifts that I got just from the few experiences I had learning from her and learning the traditions that she felt were important to pass down. And she saw in me and many other young women a power that we couldn't see in ourselves. And now I see the things that she taught me and myself and her daughter and other people who she helped support, like my friend Morley, who's a beautiful singer. And I just think that that's the kind of elder and ancestor I want to be. And so I've just had a lot of people who have given me the gift of that generosity. And that's why I want to get that wisdom while we can. And I want to give in them a sense that the wisdom that they have shared will be cultivated, supported, and honored while I'm here and while this generation is here to continue to move it forth. And I can't wait until I can be that for the next generation.
Yeah, that notion of, a thread of your inner discernment. Mm. And then also this notion of embodying being an ancestor today. That's not something I've thought of. What is it like to be the ancestor that I want to be in this moment as a relatively middle life person? That's such a beautiful challenge and thinking.
I think of that often because I think none of us know how long we have in this world. We can only show up in our present and show up the best that we can for the greater good. And when I wake up in the morning, I just want to do what it is I was sent here to do, what I was called to do that will make the world better, mm-hmm. even if I might not be here to reap the benefits of that. And I think, that's very much an indigenous worldview, but I also really think that it's leading me to think about the connections to the ancestors a lot and what it means for me as I become an elder. And I have a ways to go before I do, but it's in my mind, what kind of legacy do I want to create? What kind of lineage, what kind of circle of love and family and community do I want to leave behind? And it doesn't necessarily mean that I do that by having children that I birthed. But that's what those women have given me. They weren't women who birthed me. They have taught me a lot of things. And I'm also lucky to have a mother who taught me a great many things and was the person who really helped me see that I had power even when I didn't understand that I did, that her own inherent sense of self-possession and humility at the same time, self-actualization and inherent dignity, trusting her own sense of what is right and good, her own value even when others would say that she wasn't valued through policy and law, literally, because she was raised through Jim Crow, that all of those things have helped me and just having had that sense. And I think what mothers do in the mothers that birth you and others is that they teach you how to mother the world and they teach you how to nurture. Mother isn't something that has to do with gender. It's about nurturing. It's about bringing forth life and generative life, and it's about healing and caring and supporting another generation. And so all of those people have done that for me in a myriad of ways that are still unfolding for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky that they show up. And I think what I've learned, which I recently just decided I've learned, is that if you are open to receiving the gifts of wisdom that elders have for you, they will come to you. Mm. I have that very much in several people who've just come to me and said, I have things that you need to learn that I can share. And I want to offer this to you. And I say yes, because I know that those gifts wouldn't come if there wasn't a greater, higher reasoning for it, that I have prayed for many years for clarity and guidance in many occasions for many different trials, and those things have been showing up for me in the form of mentorship and partnership and love.
I think about folks who are privileged, communities of privilege, communities of European descent, of which I am one, who have been divorced from their ancestral lines, that there's been a real loss, that's been a real separation, that's really impoverished a lot of us. So to hear you talk about that and to hear you say if you're open to it is empowering. How do we get that back, which has not been passed on to us through the past few generations. Because I definitely grieve that, and I seek trying to find that. And I think that generational view of time that sustains you, that you've talked about right now, is one that is incredibly hopeful and nourishing, to not be in this election cycle, in this whatever, you know, presidential cycle.
After the election in 2016, I was really upset about the state of our nation, and I felt really sad and a sense of betrayal that so many of the white women in our country voted for someone who was a sexual predator and many other things. And I was upset. And I remember feeling for a very short time that I didn't know if I wanted to do anything anymore, that I felt that I had done my part, and why wouldn't other women do their part? And I remember calling my mother and saying, I can't believe this happened. We've done our part. Over 90% of black women voted against him. What should we do? And she very intensely just said, you have to get on up. You have 24 hours to mourn this situation. You got to get to work. This is not the worst thing that has happened to you or your people. And this won't be the last trial that you will suffer. And you've got to do the work. And it wasn't about taking on labor that other people very rightfully need to do. It wasn't that. It was about understanding that other people are going to do things that we may not be able to control, but what is it that we can control and what we can do in our own power at any given moment? What is the decision that we can make? And that piece of ancestral wisdom from her is something that came from other people that taught her the same. She had said that during the civil rights movement, there were many times in which she felt like, wow, you know, these people are beating me. They're literally torturing me and other people. And that her mind was still really on the understanding that she knew that the work would continue no matter what happened in that moment, that the next generation would continue to do it and the next generation would continue to do it until we get free. And her encouragement for me was saying, look what I have been through. You have an opportunity now with the skills, the voice, the passion that you have to do your part. And I will be standing right with you in the fight. But you can't give up now. This is a part of a longer trajectory of work that has been done to set the foundation of change. And if you are to let go now, you're not just letting yourself down, but you're also not contributing to this larger threat of change that other people have been contributing to over time. And so I really think that has been a gift, to understand that change can take a long time. We want it to be rapid. When we want positive change, we want the quick solutions. But often through history, we've seen that we have to continue to work together, continue to change, continue to push. And sometimes that's uncomfortable, and sometimes the rewards are not instantaneous. And the Coretta Scott King quote that talks about how struggle has to be fought and won in every generation is a really important summary of that, I think, that she really understands that as well. And I think that being in the position that she was in, to truly understand that, is important. You know, I often think about how people talk about Martin Luther King's life without talking about what a struggle it was for Coretta Scott King and her family to get his birthday as a holiday. That there are politicians who we exalt as progressives now who didn't vote for that. That they didn't think that Martin Luther King needed a holiday. And now there are many people who just take for granted the fact that that holiday was a very, very hard fought. And I think to her, I wonder, was she thinking about her own wise words about struggle needing to be fought and won in every generation when she thought, wow, my family has made the ultimate sacrifice. We have done all of this work, myself and my husband included. And we still are encountering so much pushback to even honoring his life and what he's done for this country, right? And so I just think that there's so much that we can learn from that lesson of endurance and of continuance and of instilling in the next generation the values and tools they need so the work can continue, even if we're not here to continue it.
And you're Coretta Scott King, and you, I mean, some folks have big jobs, bigger jobs than others. And that's not a judgment. That's just the truth. And I hear in that call to your mom was like, I have done this work for, you know, decades and in your young life. Mm-hmm. And it wise words, but to just pause and to credit Scott King, I mean, it just doesn't end. And to think, you know, to develop, you know, the spiritual endurance, that the calling in to say, okay, I have been given a huge job this lifetime. And
it's really hard, right? This idea of, you know, and I think in our society, we're often thinking, wow, this person's not carrying their water. And what does that mean for me? And I think when you think about capitalism, or you think about this idea that there's an exact fairness that can exist in this structure that we have, which is a system of domination and oppression, that we do kind of get caught up in saying, well, this isn't exactly the way that we would want things to go. And so we just stop because the system itself is inherently flawed. And I just think that there's a third way to approach this in terms of building a new way or a new way to approach. Not to say that the people who are giving, the people who are doing, the people who are working should have to carry water for other people or labor for other people in indignant ways. That's not what I'm saying. It's more to recognize that there's an interest that the people who aren't carrying their water have in those of us who are letting go of the things that we've fought for. And I think that that is something that motivates me sometimes when I think, oh, why do I have to do this, but other people aren't? Is thinking that, well, if I don't step up and do the work, who will? If this is what I really want for myself and my family and my community, then I have to make sure that my voice is heard and that my work is out there. And I don't deign to say that everyone has to follow this kind of path, but I do believe for me that I'm okay with the commitments that I've made and taking on what I've taken on, because I do believe that I was born with purpose that I want to actualize in this life. Mm-hmm. And for people who feel that, I would encourage them to lean into that with the understanding that we need self-care and that we don't have to do everything. We don't have to be all the things because we can't. But to also recognize that there's nothing wrong with hearing a calling and going toward it. Mm.
You know, you mentioned white women, you know, 53% of which voted for Trump, and the wider feminist movement. And this sense that to build a social movement, a women's movement, or any movement, any social change, requires, you know, a vision and a constant pushing of a way forward and an envisioning of a better future that we can't, you know, to imagine something different than what we currently have, and a real push for progress, while also constantly nurturing new energy and bringing on folks, onboarding folks who and changing hearts and minds who do not necessarily buy into that vision yet. Mm-hmm. So holding both of those things in your experience and wisdom with as a student of social movement, as a leader of social movement.
What I have been really leaning into myself lately is this understanding that I have vision, I have voice, and I have a sense of truth that has come from my experiences that I want to share with people in the world just as much as I want to hear their vision, their voice, and their truth. And one of the things I've been asking myself to do in practice has been to do more deep listening to people who might not agree with me but have the alignment in values with me in terms of core values, to understand whether or not the schism that we have between our views are inoperable, I guess would be the way that I would say it, or whether there's a place where bridges can be built. When I see people who share my values but might not use the words that I use, might not have the same context, might not have the same inspiration or approach or style of approach to get to the destination, but have a final destination that is similar to the one where I want to go, I will take time to nurture those relationships, to listen more, to think about how I might talk to them in different ways, to give them resources and share and ask them for resources about the views they have so I can learn more about where they're coming from. And when I encounter people who are diametrically just not in alignment with my values and a core human sense, I then decide to, in the words of Maxine Waters, reclaim my time. And I do that lovingly in saying that I really do believe, and maybe it's the evangelical background that I came from, that every heart and mind can change, and that I do believe in the goodness of humans. During the last election, I had a couple of people reach out to me personally to tell me that they decided to vote for Hillary Clinton because of conversations that I'd had with them, because of the particular way that I explained why I was supporting her, not necessarily just about an investment in her as a candidate with all of her pluses and minuses, as all candidates have, but in terms of investing in the people who she was lifting up and hiring. And so I had several people who had been very opposed to supporting her after the primary say that me talking to them about a larger strategy beyond a candidate, beyond an individual, but one about really looking at who would be empowered by her pattern of hiring women of color and young women of color in leadership positions, helped them see this as a different, larger strategy for how they wanted to vote. And that was a really interesting gift for me, to have people actually email me back, even though the outcome wasn't one in which she ended up winning the Electoral College. It was just kind of understanding that maybe some of the people who sent those emails to me in the moment, I felt like I was speaking in a way that was just going past them, that they weren't listening, and that there had been moments of frustration, feeling like I hadn't been heard, when in actuality, they had heard me. I have had that experience as well. I've written about this. When I was a child, there was my great aunt and my grandmother were domestic workers in a home, and one of the days my cousin was coming to pick them up from work, and a driver drove out of nowhere, was speeding, and ended up ending my great aunt's life and injuring my grandmother very critically. And in the moment, in the fray, in all of the heated conversation that happened, it kept coming up that the person who ended up ending their life in this tragic accident was an undocumented immigrant. And at the time, there was a lot of anger and a seeking of wanting there to be revenge. And then, and frustration that she didn't have insurance or that there wasn't some way to make this right. And then when my grandmother kind of woke up from the crash, her first question was, how was the baby? Because she noticed that the driver was pregnant when the collision happened. And that kind of brought everyone back to humanity and thought, wow, the problem isn't necessarily that this person is undocumented. The problem is that we have a society in which a person who's undocumented was trying to drive themselves very quickly to a medical appointment because they didn't have support, they didn't have the documentation, they couldn't get legal licensing, they couldn't get legal ID and all the support they need. And what would have happened in a world in which that person would have been supported? We might not have had the same outcome. The problem wasn't this undocumented human. The problem was a system that made a person have to live as a fugitive on the run that resulted in the ending of these lives. And that changed my view about immigration. Mm-hmm. And I'm not proud to say that I temporarily kind of held some very xenophobic views about it, because I was hurting. And because I was upset and I wanted someone else to hurt for causing our family pain. And so I often think about that when I think about my own frustration with other people's political views, that I know that I changed. And so I do believe that other people can change too.
I want to talk about stories. So you're, you know, a young leader of this iconic feminist press where we sit in this magical space. Mm-hmm. And we know the revolutionary power of stories. So that's amazing. Life-affirming stories. I want to talk about something that's been on my mind a lot today. Gandhi said, don't mistake what's habitual for what's natural. And I think about the stories that have been lost or silenced or marginalized, forgotten, and that your whole entity, this whole organization is about, you know, finding them and bringing them to life. And we need it. They're calling us so loudly. I think about the ancestors that you and I started with. You know, I feel these stories just find us. We're here. Help channel us. Bring us to life. Is there something right now that you're really hungry and longing to tell that maybe you're getting ready to tell or you haven't told yet, but you want to?
So it's a joy every day to be able to be at the Feminist Press and be here as we look toward our 50th anniversary. So now we're at the end of our 48th year of existence. Feminist Press has existed longer than I have existed in this plane. And it's very profound for me to come to work every day and think about how I have inherited this beauty and this truth through the work of Florence Howe, our founder, who is still on our board and is amazing and will be turning 90 in March. This press was visionary, and it still is visionary. And what is exciting to me as we are working on our strategic plan and thinking about the next 50 years of feminist publishing is to really think about building on what we've already done to diversify the publishing industry by being a springboard for feminist people working in publishing, a springboard for communities that are underrepresented in this industry, a springboard for debut authors and others whose stories would otherwise not be told or whose stories might not be told in the fullest truth. We've always been unafraid to take on those stories that are too risky and too radical and too controversial in other spaces. And so to be able to have that legacy, that vision, that feels as relevant as it did in 1970 today, in this political moment of insurgency and culture where hearts and minds need to be changed, where truth needs to be uplifted in a so-called post-truth atmosphere, is very profound. We are an activist press, that we will continue to publish works that speak truth to power, and we will continue to create space for the people who are telling the stories that the world needs to hear. And just being able to be a part of that when we see attacks on freedom of expression in the press every day is such a great privilege and joy. And I just love the fact that we also have maintained the feminist underpinnings of how we do all of our work, that we still have an open submissions process so that anyone who wants to share their story with us will know that their story will be read by a human being at the press, and that we will review their manuscripts, and that we have a democratic editorial process. We have a unique gift of having an intergenerational team. We have a board that has people on the board who are close to my age and people on the board who are in their late 80s and 90s, and people on the staff who are much younger than myself, and people on the staff who are older than myself, and people of all genders who work here. And so although the wider world hasn't caught up to where we are yet, I feel really proud for us to be living as close to our values as we can, as any human can, and to continue to be striving for that every day in our vision and our values and our practice and our voice. And that's important to me.
Yeah, because the power of creating, embodying, you think about a women's college or a gender, you know, single sex, anywhere where all the women are in leadership. And I get here, you have all genders working, but you've created this microcosm of what the world can be. And that's really powerful. That I'm learning more and more, you know, when I'm jaded and cynical, I think, oh, what does it matter? But it matters. It matters greatly that you've been able to, you all have over these generations have been able to make this real.
We're the longest running feminist publisher in the world. Whenever I say that out loud or I hear someone else say it, I get chills that we are still here. This common understanding that equality for all people is important to our liberation as humans, to building empathy, to creating connection, and this global connection too. It's always been a global press. And so that has been great. And even just the joy of being able to work in a feminist workplace and to show up as yourself, I think is really great. That I read a lot of Parker Palmer's works and have gone to some of his workshops, and I do feel like feminist press is one of the places I've worked where I've felt the closest to living what he calls an undivided life, which I think is a really beautiful gift. And that's what I want for our staff and for the people who are a part of our community, to be able to live an undivided life, which is very profound. I'm still working on it, because I think in our society it's hard to do. Yeah. But it, I feel that this place has allowed me to taste it.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with Jamia Wilson. If you want more from Jamia, follow her at Jamia W. That's JAMIAW. Find Jamia's books, articles, interviews, and her upcoming speaking engagements at her website, jamiawilson.com. And go ahead and get Young, Gifted, and Black and step into your power, her books, for every young visionary in your life. Links to everything can be found at our website, 3ms.co. That's the number 3, the letters ms.co. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us.